ABC Radio Victoria. You're with Peter Somerville for the Victorian Country Hour.
Hello and a happy Friday to you. This afternoon, what to do about concerns that the EU isn't seeing our Aussie wool as clean and green? AWI reckons oil-based fibres could even get the upper hand in that part of the world. Also,
it's tough underwater for an abalone at the moment. And one of the things we think we're doing is we're doing a lot to make sure that abalone as a species actually has a future.
Just why is it tough for abalone down there? You'll find out later on. And there is some hope there because an aquaculture business with Victorian links has had some success in a very competitive prize. Love to hear from you. 0467 842 722. But we start this afternoon with the dairy industry. And there are a lot of overarching bodies in the dairy industry. You've got Dairy Australia, the Australian Dairy Products Federation representing the processors. You've got Australian Dairy Farmers. And the list goes on. Can you tell them apart? Do you know what they each do? Well, a major restructure investigating rolling some of those groups into one is well behind schedule. It all stems from the Australian Dairy Plan. That's the strategic plan for the industry, which took years to develop with the input of 1,500 people. And there's concern today about that plan and how it's proceeding. Today, United Dairy Farmers of Victoria President Paul Mumford says his members are sick of waiting.
Frankly, we're getting a little bit frustrated that it's taking so long. Now, I understand that it's a very complex and difficult piece to navigate through, and we do need time. We've also got to recognise that COVID didn't really help, but frankly, I think our members are getting anxious about where is dairy industry reform. But more importantly, I think it's high time that Victoria step up and say, well, we're 63% of the national milk pool. We've got to get our own house in order first, and we need to get that ball rolling now. So let's get on with the job and what's actually best and for Victoria and get that happening. So it's part of the conference coming up shortly that I want to start bringing this conversation into the broader farmer base, and so we can have this conversation.
What exactly do you mean by that? You say that Victoria has to step up and get their house in order. Are we talking about dairy farmers here? What do they have to do?
We've got to understand how we want to have an advocacy body here in this state. We've got to actually realise that we've got a reasonably good RDP here right around the state. So we've got three of them, West Vic Dairy, Murray Dairy and Gipps Dairy, that deliver services to our farmers. But if you go to any one of those meetings, the first four questions that they're presented with from farmers are all about advocacy. So how do we make a better industry here for Victorian farmers into the future? So we've got to make sure that advocacy is as strong as possible, because research and development cannot function without the voice of the farmer. So we've got to get our act together and make sure that the voice of the farmer is representing all farmers here in the state and across the nation. So we've got a big challenge to understand how we are going to take carriage of our industry and move it forward into the next 5, 10 and 15 years time. And I say this because we've got real problems here in the dairy industry. We've got a spectacular season which should be showing up positive milk production for the state, yet it's declining. What is the problem? Why are farmers leaving? There are a whole myriad of reasons.
There's a whole myriad of reasons why this is happening. So this is part of the discussion now, that over the next 12 months, I want Victoria to be the commanding force and leading eventually the national discussion. If Victoria get what we want and how we want to operate, that's going to influence the national body.
What do you want? Because a key part of this section, I guess, of the dairy plan is rolling advocacy in with a lot of other bodies. Are you comfortable with that? Is that the ideal outcome in your eyes?
So that was one of the recommendations from the JTT report commissioned late last year. Now, that assumes that there is a all-in-one organisation leading the industry moving forward. Now, that's a good aspirational way to look at things. But is that the right way? What we actually know is our farmers do not want processors sitting at the same table. Our farmers want a farmer chair of any organisation leading the industry, speaking for the industry. But we also have to figure out, well, how do we create and discuss policy? And so this comes down right down to farm level and regions. How do we actually bring farmers together? Now, it may be a myriad of ways. It may be the traditional hall meeting on a late Tuesday night, or it may be associating with the new smartphones where we can create policy in a debating forum. So we've got to think smart about how we want to move this industry forward and how Victoria is going to hopefully change our industry and make it grow again and, more importantly, be profitable.
I get the sense from this that you're really rallying the troops to dairy farmers listening, whether they're UDV members or not. What's your call to action? What do they need to be doing?
Well, firstly, I want to have the open discussion, and this is probably going to be part of our conference coming up later in May. So that's what I want to start having now, and hopefully within a 12-month period at the next conference, we can have clear direction and clear guidelines on how we're actually going to do this and reform our industry here in Victoria.
Just quickly, I was down in your part of the world, in Yarram, yesterday. You've had a lot of rain down there. It's looking good. These issues aside, how is the industry tracking?
Well, there's an air of positivity right across the state. You know, they are having a great season, those farmers that are committed to the dairy industry. And milk prices are reasonable. Now, I've done a lot of work on milk price, but there is an air of positivity out there. But more importantly, I think people want to get back together. I think they want the an end to COVID and start speaking with farmers again. And this is a great opportunity for our conference coming up.
United Dairy Farmers of Victoria President Paul Mumford there on why he thinks Victorian dairy farmers are getting anxious about progress on the reform identified in the Australian Dairy Plan. Perhaps you're listening, maybe you're a dairy farmer. What do you know about how that is progressing? 0467 842 722 if you'd like to get in touch. Or, of course, pick up the phone, 1300 295 222. We're going to stick with dairy for just a brief moment longer because Bega Cheese announced earlier this week that it has a new director. Western Victorian dairy farmer Harper Kilpatrick has been appointed to the board. Harper and his wife Una operate two dairy farms at Koroit, milking approximately 1,200,000 cows, which 1,200 cows. My script's not quite right there. He has been appointed to Bega as a supplier director.
The Victorian Country Hour with Peter Somerville on ABC Radio Victoria.
Do stick with us on the Country Hour this afternoon. It's not all dairy. Also coming up this half hour, yesterday you might have heard about the Queensland strawberry industry stumping up a $100,000 prize for those who go out picking strawberries. Well, it seems the strawberry industry isn't alone there. Stay tuned and you'll hear which other industry is offering an incentive. But speaking of fruit, yesterday on the program we heard that 50 Solomon Island nationals had arrived in the Sunraysia region to be sent to citrus orchards and other farms to help with harvest. A total of 1,500 seasonal workers are expected to arrive in Victoria by June. But will that be enough to complete the citrus harvest? Sunraysia Citrus Growers Chair Kevin Cock says he wants a travel bubble to be established between Australia and Pacific Island nations so that pickers can avoid quarantine delays.
Oh, it'll go a long way. The good part about that is the corporate farmers will be able to tap into that, which releases a few of the locals and that for us to harvest our fruit. So that'll be good, yep.
You're a grower in the region. Are you confident that your fruit will be picked?
Yeah, I harvested through the Valencia season during COVID, and my locals were really good. They stepped up to the plate, and we changed our harvesting system to make it easier for them, and we got out and harvested fruit ourselves. So we got through a pretty good Valencia crop. There's a fair few on-costs in employing the seasonal workers, but I think it'll suit, well, it will suit the corporate farms because they need to move a lot of fruit in a short period. The real peak will be in that June, July, August period, and that's our winter crop and navels, and that's when we need to get the bulk of the crop off for exports, domestic, and obviously there'll be a little bit of overrun there for the fresh juice market. So the timing's pretty good.
So you're quite optimistic about the coming months with labour?
Yep, and I think, we'll be out there looking for export markets that we probably haven't gone after before. If something happens to our major markets, we'll be doing what the rest of the commodities have done, looking around for new customers.
A New Zealand and Australian travel bubble has been announced recently, and there have been calls from the South Australian citrus industry to extend that to Pacific Island nations to avoid delays with quarantine. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, that would be fantastic if the government could look at that, because it's just a huge cost. 2 weeks in quarantine for, what did you say, 1,500 workers. The cost of that, one to the industry and two to the government, and then that's got to be passed on to the consumer. It just ramps up the cost of our fruit, and we can't really be pushing fruit onto people that really need to eat good fruit at a high cost. Simple as that. Now that New Zealand's looking at a bubble for travel, and New Zealand uses Pacific Island labour, they travel there all the time, and so it makes a lot of sense that we could just do direct flights. And obviously there would be all the protocols that we have on our farm would be put on those people, which is testing, stat deck that they haven't been in a COVID area, they haven't travelled overseas to COVID area. All those things would have to be done. It's just that sitting around for 2 weeks is a huge cost.
How are the crops looking for the coming month?
Yep, things are starting to colour up, so we're getting a bit of an idea on size and that. Some of the early mandarines, I ate my first navel orange yesterday, a bit chewy, it's got to have a bit more juice in it, but that's all looking good.
Sunraysia Citrus Growers Chair Kevin Cock speaking there with Eden Henninen. It's 18 minutes past 12. You're on the Country Hour, where yesterday we brought you the news of a $100,000 cash prize being offered by the Queensland strawberry industry to attract workers in this era of labour shortages. The strawberry industry estimates it needs 7,000 workers to get the job done this winter. Every fruit and vegetable grower would no doubt tell you the same thing right now. Finding and keeping workers is their biggest headache. So how are other horticultural industries responding? How Farming is the second largest banana producing operation in Australia. Longtime owner Dennis Howe told Charlie McKillop that many growers, including him, are taking matters into their own hands in the absence of leadership from government.
We have our own, we call it a retention bonus. It runs for 12 weeks, which amounts to, a couple of grand, $2,500, some of them earn $3,000. It has to be 12 weeks at 28 and a half hours or greater. And then we top it up at the end with $3 an hour, which amounts to a lot of money for over 400 or 500 people. We're not just doing it to the backpackers and casuals. You can't sort of pay them $5 and not your permanent. So everyone, including me, I guess, is earning that potentially that $5 an hour.
So how effective are those individual bonuses?
Look, it's very hard to say. According to the troops out there, the feedback, it certainly has an effect. And people are saying, oh, I'm going to stay, I'll definitely stay for 12 weeks. So, I guess we got into this because back in October, November, people were heading off to pick mangoes and now they say, oh, how much are you paying? We can get $30, $35 an hour. out picking mangoes. So we thought, well, we've got to try and do something to attract people and keep people. And it's honestly, we're short on workers still, but we're not desperately short. Must be working a little bit. But, you know, it's going to cost us $2 or $3 million over the period, or more, actually. I don't know. I'm not going to actually add it up. You know, and like when bananas are short, we get paid more. Labour's definitely short, so you just pay a little bit more.
What about at an industry level, Dennis? Should peak bodies like your own, the Australian Banana Growers Council, be out there matching these kind of initiatives? Or
Look, I don't know that it's their place to do that, Charlie. And trying to organise it all would be a nightmare. You know, like that strawberry growers thing. Well, that's a one-off. Whether, you know, how much effect that's going to actually have.
Does it worry you when you hear about initiatives like that, big kind of sexy prizes like $100,000? Can you imagine that a couple of young backpackers deciding, should I go north to pick avocados or bananas or stay down here and pick strawberries, that it might be enough to get them across the line?
There's a bit of a worry, but it's, you know, it's a free country, each to their own. And don't know, Charlie, it does worry you, but it's, as I said, it's a free country and people can do as they wish. You know, if the government had any statesmanship or initiative, they'd come out and every backpacker or illegal worker that's in Australia at the moment, they'd have an amnesty and say, right, if you guys work 2 years in rural industry or 4 years, you're going to get Australian citizenship, you know, because they're all, as long as they work. That would help a lot because there's no carrot at the end of the stick. They're stuck here as soon as they can. A lot of them are going to go home. It's going to be a long time before new ones come. So, you know, I think the government has to show a bit of leadership and let these people stay, make them, because they're all good, they'll all be good Australians. They're here to work. They like working, like Australia.
That's the crux of the issue, isn't it? These types of initiatives are being born out of frustration that whatever the government's doing is not enough to actually grow the labour pool. It's just...
It's hopeless. Yeah, nothing. Nothing at all. And, you know, if you think the $5,000 or $6,000 relocation money that's being offered, we've had about 2 inquiries for that, and they're just inquiries. That's as far as I've got.
Dennis Howe from Major Banana Producers up in Queensland, Howe Farming. He says the government relocation incentives haven't delivered a single extra worker in his busy banana packing shed on the Atherton tableland. Meanwhile, the Australian Banana Growers Council has all but ruled out implementing any industry staff incentives like that $100,000 prize we heard from the Queensland strawberry sector.
Hi, Heather Ewart here. Join me for Backroads as we travel to the more remote towns and regions of Australia. From Cobar to Cloncurry.
Really good life, really.
Strawn to Cooper Pedy and many more in between.
There are sand, there's dust, there's lots of flies, there's very large mosquitoes.
We discover all that magnificent rural and regional Australia has to offer and celebrate the amazing people living life just off the backroads of Australia.
Backroads, Thursday nights at 8 on ABC TV and streaming on iView.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
It's 23 minutes past 12. The latest news not too far away for you. But firstly, a major player in Australia's wool industry is worried that farmers could feel the flow-on effects of changes to Europe's economy. The European Union is in the midst of a sustainability overhaul as part of the European Green Deal, and there are worries that wool isn't being seen as clean and green. Bridget Herman reports.
The European Commission is reforming major parts of the European Union's economy as part of the European Green Deal.
Our aim is to make sure that Europe can become, by 2050, carbon neutral, meaning that we wouldn't emit more greenhouse gases than we can absorb.
That's Vivian Lonella, the coordinating spokesperson for the deal at the European Commission. She says the EU is focusing on changes in its society and economy to reach their aim of carbon neutrality.
And textile sector is there, of course, something very important because it has such a key role in our economy and society. But also, it's a very resource-intensive sector with an important contribution to negative climate and environmental effects. When we look at it on the statistics, it's the 4th highest pressure category for the use of primary raw materials and water. And it's the 5th on greenhouse gas emissions. So from the point of view of environmental concerns, We very much want to make sure that we're able to bring the textiles into the circular economy model that we are developing, to make sure that we use less resources, we reuse them, and also when we can't reuse, we recycle.
Ms. Lonella says they're currently looking at how to implement all those ideas into the sector.
We are working now with the industry on developing precise category rules, which are based on the environmental footprint, to calculate the impact of apparel products. And this is work that is ongoing, and we plan to finish it in about a year's time from now. And this is exactly this, that we are looking at how to measure the environmental performance of the products and to see really the whole life cycle of them, from the extraction of the raw materials until the end of life. And an important point there is to establish whether natural fabrics have lower environmental impacts than synthetic fabrics or not. And we are using objective methods there to measure the environmental impacts of all products and to quantify them according to those environmental impact categories. When we look at raw materials, we want to make sure that the environmental impacts of any raw material would be accounted following the same rules, and the same outcome of the study can be used to identify which material is more suitable from the environmental point of view.
Coming from the other side of the world, Australia's wool industry is getting involved in the process.
Australian Wool Innovation is participating in the EU's working group responsible for calculating the footprint of clothing.
Angus Ireland is the program manager of eco-credentials at AWI. He says the union's textile overhaul is a commendable initiative, but he has concerns.
It's clear to us that unless their governing rules change, they will prevent the positive attributes of natural fibres from being counted. Fibres like wool, cotton and cashmere are renewable. They can be regrown every year while ever the sun shines and the rain falls. And at the end of their life, they are fully biodegradable, returning their nutrients to the soil for use again. Unlike fossil fuel fibres, they don't clog up the world's overflowing landfills with material that will persist indefinitely. And they don't contribute to the microplastic pollution problem with its growing list of health and environmental impacts. So all of these attributes of natural fibres should ideally be scored, and scored well, but the EU's governing rules currently prevent them from being counted. Our view, our strong view, is that it's not going to represent a level playing field, and that oil-based fibres will be advantaged because their score is not being discounted for the fact that they're not renewable and not biodegradable.
Ms. Lonella says the union is liaising with stakeholders. She says the goal is to objectively find the best outcome for the environment.
It's important to keep in mind that we look at all the life cycle. So it's not only, you know, when we speak, for example, what you raised yourself, wool, we speak a lot about the land, air and water use. But here we speak of the whole life cycle, meaning that, for example, this whole issue with microplastics is very, very important therein. So we really want to make sure that we put the different elements which are stronger and weaker in different categories of textiles into the same mold somehow and try to calculate on that basis.
Mr. Ireland says AWI is working with the EU to improve the process.
So we're working inside the tent to the degree we possibly can. And we have our LCA, life cycle assessment experts, I should say, working there to develop and propose methodology to address the limitations of the EU system. But the wheels really are turning quite slowly over there, and at this stage they're reluctant to move away from their, they've got a kind of a one-size-fits-all methodology.
Australian Wool Innovations, Angus Ireland there. Peter Somerville here with you for the Country Hour this afternoon. You can, of course, get in touch with me, 0467 842 722. And I have a text here. We'll, of course, get to the Weather Bureau in just a second. But this one has really surprised me. Trevor from Barool here in Gippsland has got in touch. 10.5 millimetres of rain there, which I wasn't expecting to see, but maybe you've had some too. Do let me know, 0467 842 722. We'll head to the Weather Bureau, but first to the latest news headlines with Jed Acosta joining me here in real life in the studio.
Good afternoon, Pete. Making news. The Victorian government has announced the McCure Hotel and Convention Centre will host Ballarat's high-volume vaccination clinic. Ballarat Health Service says it's expecting to start immunising priority frontline workers on Monday, but the federal government last night announced the Pfizer jab as the preferred vaccine for people under 50 amid concerns about potential blood clots linked to AstraZeneca. The decision has left health experts unsure about vaccine rollout in the region. The state government says it was on track to deliver 300,000 doses by the middle of May. A southwest Victorian mayor wants the peak body for Victorian councils to lobby the state government to ensure towns that host new wind farms derive tangible benefits from the projects. The Moyne Shire Council has 400 wind turbines, a number that would be double if all proposed wind farms in the region are approved. Mayor Daniel Mead says the towns hosting the wind farms need to benefit from the new projects. The state government is spending $33.7 million on a new road safety camera technology to catch distracted drivers. A recent three-month trial in Victoria found one in 42 drivers illegally use a mobile phone behind the wheel. The camera technology can also detect drivers who are not wearing a seatbelt and other dangerous behaviours such as pets on laps. Another $700,000 from the state government has been announced to help women in communities hard hit by the Black Summer bushfires. Most of the funding will go towards women's health services in Gippsland and the North East. But $285,000 will also be shared among five fire-affected shires, including East Gippsland and the Alpine Shire. And snow is expected to fall across the Alpine region this weekend, with Mount Hotham and Mount Baw forecast to reach just zero degrees on Sunday. A cold front will sweep across the northeast in Victoria, bringing temperatures down following a week of warm weather. Forecasters say slightly warmer weather will return early next week ahead of another cold front. For more local regional news, visit ABC Rural.
Thank you very much, Jenna Costa, there with the latest news headlines, and a nice segue there to the weather as well. But snow on the way by the sounds of it. Also a text here from Laurel in Beaufort. 6.5 millimetres there overnight. Let's head to the Bureau of Meteorology, though, because Michael Efron is on the line. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Peter.
Just how much rain has there been around?
Yeah, we saw generally around 1 to 5 millimetres across much of southern and mountain Victoria, but there were parts that saw some higher falls. The East Central District received around 5 to 15, and similar falls were seen across parts of West Gippsland as well. So, unfortunately, not a lot was recorded north of the Divide, typically less than 1 or 2 millimetres there. So, just a light drink, really, for southern parts of the state overnight. But at the moment, we do have just some light showers affecting the south in a southwesterly airstream following the passage of that front overnight. And that does mean quite a cool day across the state, especially in the south. Temperatures are headed for the mid to high teens. Today, we're looking at a top of 19 at Geelong, elsewhere 19 at Sale and Bairnsdale. Ballarat only getting up to 15, Hamilton up to 17, but north of the Divide getting into the low to mid-20s, 24 at Mildura, 21 at Echuca, 22 at Wangaratta. And north of the Divide, we are seeing some breaks in the cloud as well, but in the south, it is a mostly cloudy afternoon. But heading into the weekend, we will see a strong cold front crossing the state throughout the latter part of Saturday. So we'll see showers developing across most districts, but especially across the south of the state, and freshening southwesterly winds as well. And as your news report mentioned, really cold air. So we'll see snowfalls developing across the Alpine peaks during the morning, but then throughout Saturday evening, we'll see snow level dropping to around 900 metres, so some pretty cold air coming through. Some local hail and thunder developing in the south as well, but mainly focused towards the coast. And in terms of temperatures, we are looking at relatively mild conditions ahead of that front, hitting the low 20s across the north and high teens through the south of the state. And With those wet and windy conditions developing, we have issued a graziers warning for much of the south. So a bit of a change in conditions coming up. But as we head into Sunday, we do see the showers continuing over southern districts in particular. Very strong and cold southwesterly winds as well. Snow initially above 900 metres elevation on Sunday, but that will lift throughout the day. And once again, some local hail and thunder in the south to start the day. And in terms of temperatures, only getting into the low to mid-teens in the south, mid to high teens across the north. And I should add that in terms of rainfall totals across each day through the weekend, typically 1 to 5 millimetres in the south and some very light falls through the north. But I think each day we will see some isolated higher falls through parts of the east central district, west Gippsland, and down through the Otways as well, 5 to 15 millimetres in those areas. So not a really wet system coming through, but some useful falls across the south. Pardon me, but as we push into early next week, we do see a large high-pressure system approaching from the west, and so on Monday we'll see just one or two showers in the south, dry conditions through the north, temperatures in the north still in the high teens or low 20s, and in the south looking at the mid to high teens. The winds will be easing as well, potentially some local frost across the north on Monday morning. And then on Tuesday, that high-pressure system crosses the state. So we are looking at a much warmer day with the winds tending northerly, hitting the mid-20s through the north, low 20s across the south, a dry day expected as well. We will, however, see northerly winds freshening over western and southwestern and central districts, rather, throughout the latter part of the day, and that's ahead of a frontal system which will push through during Wednesday. So very windy overnight Tuesday into Wednesday, especially across elevated areas. But in terms of rainfall, not a lot expected with this system. So on Wednesday, we'll have just a few showers still over southern and mountain districts. Not a lot getting into the north, unfortunately. And pretty warm through the north as well, hitting the mid-20s there, low 20s through the south. And then on Thursday, we do get another high-pressure ridge building from the west. So pretty settled by that stage, temperatures in the north into the low 20s and high teens across the south. And I should add that the system coming through Tuesday and Wednesday is actually the remnants of the tropical cyclone that is approaching WA at the moment. So we'll bring some really gusty winds, but unfortunately a lot of the moisture will have disappeared by then.
Well, Michael, I'm listening to this hoping that everyone enjoyed the sunshine yesterday, because it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of warmth for the next couple of days.
That's exactly right. I think Tuesday's our best chance, but even then, not getting anywhere near what we had over recent days.
Okay, well, hope they made the most of it. Michael Efron, thanks for the update.
Thanks, Peter. All the best.
And to you too. Michael Efron there is a senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. And I don't know why I was surprised with those rainfall texts, but we had so little rain here in Sale last night. I think it was only a millimetre or two. But we've got another text here that's surpassed 10. Jill at Tynong North has had 10.5 millimetres of rain. Still some light showers there today. And also in that sort of part of the world, Paul from Trafalgar says 6 millimetres there, and there's a couple of showers around now as well. 10 millimetres over at Skipton, that one from Michael, and 3 in Drummond as well.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
21 minutes to 1. Well, you've been hearing a bit from the Royal Easter Show in Sydney this week, but there's a big accolade with a Victorian connection today. It's touted as the ultimate award in agricultural excellence at the Sydney Show. And this year, Yumba Aquaculture was a finalist in the President's Medal. They produce spat and grow-out green lip abalone for domestic and overseas markets. Some of that happens right here in Victoria, near Portland. Owner Anthony Hall is speaking here at Government House in Sydney with David Claughton, who asked how the output of farmed abalone compares with the wild sector now.
Well, if you compare it against the largest wild sector fishery Yes, we actually produce more tonnes than, for instance, as a sector combined, as compared to the largest fishery in Tasmania, which is fantastic because it means that, and we're producing a product the world wants. So it doesn't matter whether it's wild or farmed, there's not enough. So we have this great situation that we're actually, in reality, not in competition with the wild sector.
And that's because global stocks in the wild fishery are declining significantly, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, very sadly, only in the last 2 days, the wild fishery in California has been halted for another 5 years. And global warming, lack of food for abalone, it's tough underwater for an abalone at the moment. And one of the things we think we're doing is we're doing a lot to make sure that abalone as a species actually has a future.
And you export your product as well, like most other abalone producers. Were you affected by COVID, or were you affected by the trade war with China?
We were affected by COVID practically because obviously there was a reduction of demand in the food service sector, but we are not focused purely on the food service sector. We have a big retail presence through many of the major supermarkets. In terms of export, we're also not focused on only one country. So because of the flexibility of our marketing organisation, we actually helped sustain a lot of the Australian abalone farmed industry by providing a route to market for them, because their traditional market to restaurants was denied, but we had a market, say, to Los Angeles or Canada or some of these other countries where they wanted our brand, and we were able to actually take some of that product up.
One of the things that I picked up from your presentation for this award was that you're making abalone affordable for the average consumer. Is that right? Like, what kind of a product do you produce? How affordable is it?
Well, you can go to one of the major chains, buy a kilogram of abalone frozen and shell for around about $50. And, it may have anywhere between 8 to 14 individual abalone in it. Make a wonderful cocktail at home for presenting to guests, or actually doing it as a wonderful entree. It presenting it in that smaller size, which is one of the distinguishing things that we have against the wild sector, because by law, the wild sector must harvest at a particular age and size, and the result is an individual abalone is expensive and luxurious. Our farmed abalone are just as luxurious, but they're less expensive because they're smaller.
And tastier, I heard you say.
Yeah, well...
on what basis? Is there a scientific basis for that?
Yeah, well, you did say that's because I said so, but... The reason is, and it's as in much of other farming, what you feed an animal affects the way it tastes. And so we're actually feeding a high-protein diet to the abalone. We have to trick the abalone into thinking that it's eating seaweed. And we do that using a soy flour-based aqua feed that we make ourselves in Adelaide. And that feed has got a higher protein, and that means fundamentally that you end up with a flesh that is slightly sweeter, it's less tough, it is different to the wild abalone, and of course to my taste superior.
And that's a unique product too globally, isn't it? Because green lip abalone isn't produced anywhere else.
It's endemic to Australia, only us, so unless somebody overseas takes live abalone and
Well, that's happened before, not with abalone, is it? But macadamias, there'd be a whole bunch of Australian things.
Yeah, but then we have our provenance, because one of the things about our farms, they're in the most beautiful places in Australia. Port Lincoln, Kangaroo Island, Narrawong near Portland, Bishano in Tasmania, crashing waves of the southern sea, smell the salt, the sea, see the, the sand, everything. There is a provenance story to our hand-reared farm product that even if somebody did grab the genetics and do it somewhere else, I think people will want to pay for.
We were talking earlier about the enormous potential for the farm sector to support the wild sector because they produce this enormous number of spat. Mm. Is that something that you're looking at, the ability to transfer abalone into the wild?
It's a dream of ours because we're passionate about abalone, not because it's a business proposition. The situation for abalone in the wild is that it's threatened. Yeah, like in Australia, there are only one or two sustainable fisheries, which means that if nothing is done, that the species will die out. It will become an incredibly rare to non-existent thing, and that's not something we like. You know, we're passionate about the sea, diving. You know, we're coastal corporate citizens, and what is important to us is to make sure that something like that, a really important Australian endemic species, has a future. So we think we've got the toolbox, the recipe. We can create, you know, in our hatcheries, we're able to create or have born, you know, millions of young abalone, and they need a home.
Anthony Hall from Yumba Aquaculture speaking there with David Claughton. And as you've just heard, the Royal Easter Show is continuing in Sydney. And did you know this? It's shaping up as the biggest ticketed event in the world this year. But running it, of course, was a massive risk in these COVID times. Daryl Jeffrey is the Chief Operating Officer for the Society. And last year, he sat down with New South Wales Health to talk about how they could make this show happen. David Claughton asked him how hard it was to get this approved.
Yeah, you're right. It was unprecedented, right? So at that stage, the most that they'd approved for anything was, I think, 45,000 or 50,000 to the NRL Grand Final. For us to then say to them, can you approve us to have 60,000 per day over 12 days, you know, 720,000. We essentially want to run the largest attended event in the world in a pandemic. You're right. It was a leap of faith.
Because a huge risk, really. It could have turned into a public health disaster.
A massive risk to take. But we were wiped out from the Easter show, from the 2020 show, obviously. And then, you know, we would normally start planning the Easter show for the following year in, call it, July of the previous year. So we didn't make a decision to run this show until December 1. So we had a 16-week lead-in, which was absolutely unprecedented as well. And you're right, through the whole period, we were tossing up through our board and our executive, you know, do we actually want to take this risk? Is it worth it to us to take this risk? Because, you know, we lost a substantial amount of money last year, millions of dollars. As a not-for-profit, that's hard to swallow. So did we want to go and take that risk again? But I think when we weighed up, you know, the pros and cons, we decided, you know, for the our not-for-profit charter, which is agriculture, and, you know, for the show is all about bringing the country to the city, we made the decision that we had to take that risk. We knew we were going to lose money again on this year's show, but we just thought we needed to do it again because we'd had, you know, the year before, and we didn't want to be, you know, 2 years of not having the Royal Easter Show and, you know, and the support for the agricultural industry in Sydney and New South Wales, and also just for the events industry. Like, we also wanted to take an approach where if we could get this event off the ground, the rest of the event industry in New South Wales and the greater Australia would say, well, if you can run the Easter show, you can run any event. And that was very mindful for us and front of mind, that we wanted people to look at us and say, you know, if I'm scared about running my event or I'm concerned about running my event, but they can run that event, surely I can do my event, because it doesn't get any bigger than the Easter show.
And what about the things you had to change? We know that on a big day you might crank 120,000, so a 60,000 cap is significant. But what else did you have to sacrifice?
Well, one of the key things was cost. So, you know, the cost to put on an event with a COVID overlay is significant of this scale. And there's no return for that. It's just a straight cost to you above and beyond what you would normally spend, and you're getting nothing for it. You know, everything else you do throughout the show, there's an investment and there's a return on it.
Was there anything else that had to give way?
We had to give... Well, numbers was your number one, right? So on a Good Friday, I think in 2019, we had 128,000 people here on Good Friday. So this year, we obviously had 60,000, so that's half. So in terms of that, you then need to adjust your cost base in terms of what you're actually doing at the show. So we just had to be a bit smarter with what we delivered in terms of activations and the like. But I think the general public wouldn't have really noticed that. We've got less stuff across sites, so as in less activations. There's but that's two prongs. That also gives you more space in terms of your internal pavilions. One of our biggest issues has been controlling access internally, because even though we can have that 60,000 square metre, all of our internal spaces are still limited to 2 square metre per person in there. So we need to be able to manage the number of people we allow into those internal spaces at any one time.
So you've had a lot more people on the doors?
Yeah, so a lot of those... We've used a technology system, first of its kind, by a company named PMY, which is a people counting technology, and it's actually 74 cameras mounted across site at entry and exit doors, and it's counting people in and out through body mass as they enter these pavilions. And we're running a traffic light system. When it's green, the public can flow freely. Once those percentages hit 76%, it'll flip to orange or amber. And then we will start to deploy teams to control entry in and out of those spaces. And obviously when it gets to red, it's, you know, one in, one out.
And you've got signage around the place, you know, this, you've got to keep your distance, you know, don't go in there, blah, blah, blah. But it's very hard. Even the public, you know, may not be aware of some of this stuff. So are there breaches? Are there additional risks? Because it's very hard to actually physically control that with so many people.
I wouldn't say we've had any breaches because I think the public have been generally compliant with what we've put in place. And I think the New South Wales, I think Australian public, in terms of what they've had to do with COVID, are generally compliant people. So I wouldn't say we've had any breaches whatsoever. Western Sydney Health have visited us a number of times who are managing it on the ground. They haven't raised anything of major concern that they wanted us to adjust.
Royal Agricultural Society Chief Daryl Jeffrey speaking there with David Claughton about how they've managed to put on what could become the biggest ticketed event in the world this year. 9 minutes to one on the Country Hour. We're coming home now because stone fruit harvest has come to an end, but organic farmer Ant Wilson is still noticing signs of fruit fly in his orchard at Harcourt in central Victoria. It's the first time he and many other backyard growers have had the pest on their properties. He spoke with Eden Henninen about what he's doing to better manage fruit fly next season.
This year's been the first year that we've found fruit fly. We've got a positive ID on the property. It's definitely been Bendigo and Harcourt and Castlemaine and around the area in the last few years. But this was the first time we thought here. And so we just did what we could, what we knew with, you know, with the limited information that we had. We increased our trapping and monitoring, and we're using some sprays and other things to reduce the chances of spreading any larvae or eggs. So we were keeping fruit in the chiller for longer than normal before getting it out to consumers and stuff like that. Yeah, and so now it's the end of the harvest season and it's kind of trailing off now. It's become less of a priority because I've finished harvesting. But it's likely, now that it's here, I dare say it's here to stay, especially if next year is a La Nina as well, that where the pattern seems to favour the fly. So, yeah, I dare say it's going to be here next year and we'll just have to continue managing and monitoring for it.
When you talk about sprays and traps, what kind of sprays are you using? Because you're an organic farm, so does that make it a little difficult?
Yeah, there's only one, as far as I know, that's allowed in an organic system. So we're using that one. You know, I always had dreams for the last couple of years. I've been experimenting with poultry and things, using more sort of ecological methods to try to control the fly. So, you know, hopefully we can tend in that direction over time. But just as a sort of quick solution and a quick reaction that we had on hand, we've used that one spray that we're allowed to use.
And you said that you're nearing the end of harvest. How much fruit did you have to throw out?
That's a really good question. It's hard to know, really, but because we didn't really have any experience with it, we didn't really know what we were doing and we just kind of had to figure it out as we went along. My fear was that it would be impossible to tell if fruit had been affected, but it seemed in practice that if I couldn't see from the outside that it had been affected, then you wouldn't really notice when you ate it. So you might, you know, people might be eating really, really, really tiny fruit fly eggs or something like that without even knowing, and probably have been for a long time. Yeah, there was plenty of fruit around that I could actually identify that had been infected, and that fruit I had to just remove and obviously treat it in the chiller so that the larvae died and then feed it to animals. Yeah, in terms of the quantity, not a huge amount, to be honest. It didn't seem to get out of hand. Without the combined trapping and spray that we were using, it seemed to keep it in check.
So, and Agriculture Victoria said that this is more of a problem for backyard farmers and organic farmers such as yourself. Have you spoken to others in the area that are having a similar problem?
I mean, I've spoken to other home growers and stuff at the farmers markets and, that have just said, you know, they've lost their entire crop of tomatoes or peaches or whatever it is. But we're kind of encircled here with non-certified organic growers, so I don't think they're too worried about it because they just have more tools available. And just going back to your previous question as well, what it did mean was that any fruit, while I was grading the fruit, anything that I suspected might have been impacted by the fly, I had to throw away. So it's really hard to know if there's a piece of fruit that's a little bit soft. Is it soft just because it's ripe or because it's got fruit fly larvae in it or because of some other reason?
Harcourt organic farmer Ant Wilson there speaking with Eden Hennenden. Peter Somerville with you for the Country Hour this afternoon. Quickly, before we wrap up, Australian thoroughbred prices continue to bolt with the Easter yearling sale in Sydney this week, grossing more than $132 million. The top price for the sale was a colt by Snitzel, which sold for $2.5 million. Managing Director of Inglis, Mark Webster, says the results were incredible.
Well, I think this year's Easter sale was just a spectacular result. Yeah, we traded $132 million, which is the highest turnover since the pre-GFC days in 2008. The average price of the yearlings that we offered is $372,000. And, of course, these are horses that haven't been broken in yet or tested. They're literally babies that have been grown out on farms and brought here for sale before even having a saddle on their back. And we sold 22 yearlings for $1 million or more. So that's not a record, but it's a significant result, and particularly noting this has all been done off the back of a COVID period, and we had very few internationals here due to the travel restrictions.
Yeah, so how dominant were domestic buyers?
Well, they did most of the heavy lifting, Matt. You know, normally the Easter sale, it's one of the world's three top yearling sales. It's regarded as a truly international sale. And generally 50% of the turnover at the sale comes from international buyers. Most of them are normally present on the grounds. You know, we usually have a couple hundred internationals here from North America, Asia. We have buyers from Japan, a lot from Hong Kong normally, Singapore, but South Africa, and various parts of Europe. This year, we had six people on the grounds from overseas, you know, not 100 or 200. So that's quite remarkable. Now, there were some internationals that were bidding remotely, either online or over the phone with representatives on the ground. But nonetheless, it's nothing like having people here. You know, they always spend up more when they're here, and we didn't have that. So it was really the domestic market that was driving the sale.
So we've seen big numbers at the Easter yearling sale. We saw records broken earlier in the year at the Magic Millions on the Gold Coast. What do you think's driving these huge prices for Australian thoroughbreds?
Well, the number one thing would be the confidence people have in the racing industry here. You know, during COVID, there was one thing that was consistent right throughout. Racing carried on, albeit people weren't able to attend the races to watch their own horses for a period of time. Their horses kept running, and you know, they gave them great enjoyment while they were sitting at home on the couch. They were able to still follow their horses. They were still able to earn prize money. So I think that's a real positive. And of course, here in Australia in the last couple of years, there's been so much innovation. So many additional new races have been put on the calendar. So of course, the Everest is one of them. It's a $15 million race. It's and then we've got the Mile Race in Melbourne, which is a $500 million race, and there's been a growth of $1 million races. I think we have something like 52 million dollar races here in Australia now, which is more than any other country in the world. So people see it as an opportunity to invest, but also just as somewhere where they can have a bit of fun, but at the same time, you know, they can win some prize money.
That was the Managing Director of Inglis, Mark Webster, speaking there with Matt Brown. And a little fun fact for you, the average price at that sale was $371,000. $50,000. That's it for today's Country Hour. Angus Furley will be back with you next week. It's 1 o'clock.